And you may recall Jodie Rowley in the Science Show in January talking about her discovery of the vampire tadpole in Vietnam. She's from the Australian Museum and spends months in Southeast Asia, as does Robert Murphy from Toronto, who knows her work and how robust you have to be to seek frogs in such weather and terrain.
Yes, I met Jodie. I knew of her before, but actually met her when we were working in Vietnam in the same area. And she provided us with some assistance, and we had some wonderful conversations.
Stories about the amazing variety of creatures in the forests there. Now, to some of us, that's surprising because there are so many people in Southeast Asia, and, you know, after the war, there are all these effects of herbicides and whatever, but still you're finding amazing creatures.
When we first went in 1994, there were 87 species of amphibians and reptiles known in Vietnam, and today there's more than 300. My colleague in Russia, who does a lot of alpha taxonomy, has a desk literally packed with bottles of new species to describe. It's an amazingly diverse area and a very, very safe and wonderful place to visit. The discoveries never stop.
And which of the frogs and snakes and lizards do you particularly want to seek out yourself?
You don't see much in the daytime. So daytime we end up processing and thinking and talking, but as soon as sunset comes, we get all excited and get our gear and our headlamps and our flashlights on, and we head up some jungle stream to see what we can discover and find.
Yeah, Jodie was talking about even going up mountains where you can get very, very cold and wet.
You can get very cold and, of course, extremely wet in some of the higher mountain elevations. In northern Vietnam, we were working one spring, and it got down to 5 to 6 C at night with driving rain.
Tell me about some of the ones you found, some of the discoveries.
Actually, I guess the biggest ones we found are the stinky frogs, the genus Odorana, which I love. As we were processing animals, we noticed some had pigmented eggs, some had unpigmented eggs, and it ended up what was one species in Vietnam. At the time, we found to be at least 6 species. And now we're working on the garbage frog of Southeast Asia, and we know that it contains at least 13 different species within this complex.
Those aren't very nice names, stinky and garbage.
Well, stinky frogs stink. And if you're a graduate student who scratches your finger, and then you pick up one of these frogs and your finger kind of stings like a bee, your instinct is to put it in your mouth. And so the student put it in his mouth, and later he confessed that his mouth went numb for 7 hours. He's lucky that this is all that happened to him. But the toxins certainly exist within the skins of some of these frogs.
Well, famously, I think Mike Tyler worked on frogs whose skin have a kind of built-in insecticide, which if you're living in a place like that, clearly you don't want to be eaten up by all the kind of midges. So they do have a repulsive force against the midges themselves, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, you consider yourself as just this wet, moist mass of tissue that's there. Then, of course, the bacteria and the fungus and the insects and everything want to go and munch on you as a source of energy. But frogs tend to not get many viruses and many skin fungi, although chytrid is killing a whole lot of animals, which is not native to them. So they have built in their system and in their skins their own natural defenses. One of the unfortunate things that's happening now is that a lot of these species are going extinct. And if these frogs have this kind of defense in system, then we're losing this defense ourselves. That could be potentially useful for us.
Yeah, chytrid's a fungus. Is that spreading in Vietnam as well?
It's unknown to occur in Vietnam. There are cases of it now within China, but it doesn't seem to be having the same impact in China that it's had in the Americas. But some other things are just raving havoc. There's a virus called rhinovirus that is wiping out massive numbers of amphibians within China.
Talking about China, you go there a lot, don't you?
Quite often. Depends on who you ask. If you ask my wife, I go too much.
2 months a year, is it?
Right now, it's 4 months a year that I have a research agreement with China. We have a significant amount of money to pursue research on amphibians and reptiles and insects and other groups of animals.
Yeah, the scale of research in China is almost boggling, isn't it?
It's quite unbelievable. The amount of money that the Chinese government and provincial governments are putting into fundamental basic research is, it's mind-boggling. It's unbelievable relative to what's happening in the West.
And it's even in your field where the classification, barcoding of frogs and snakes and lizards. You wouldn't have thought that Beijing would be terribly keen on this sort of basic science.
Well, Beijing and China have made a $50 million commitment to the International Barcode of Life Project, where they've come in at a level that's equal to EU, Canada, and the US, now, the four major central nodes in the process. And they're funding this project. I'm part of a group that has $2.4 million US to start barcoding some major groups, selected groups, including amphibians and reptiles. There's some work being done with fishes, parasitic wasps that are important in terms of agricultural feedback, and some other groups of animals as well.
You must explain what is barcoding. We've had it on the Science Show before, but give us a reminder.
Ah, barcoding. We take a small fragment of DNA, the molecule that encodes life. In fact, we use mitochondrial DNA, which is only maternally inherited. And there's a small fragment of this of about 600 nucleotide base pairs that we can amplify in almost all species. And the sections tends to be so variable that every species differs. In fact, there's a lot of variation typically within species. So we can run a DNA barcode very quickly and very efficiently and identify a species without even seeing it. This has huge implications. It's already been applied in courts in China, for example, to convict people importing CITES and internationally controlled species for our use in traditional medicine.
And this is so much more efficient because it's a bit like having one fingerprint from your little finger instead of having to have the whole body. It's something that's unique but manageable.
It's the CSI of the animal world in every aspect. In the one case that we know of, importers brought in gallbladders, and no one knew what the gallbladders were just by looking at them, although we had suspicions. And so we took a subsample of these and we sequenced it, and it turned out to be two protected species.
Of what?
One was a python that was brought in, and the other was a monitor lizard. As I recall, the importers got a huge fine for China and 5 years in prison, and that would not be a very pleasant thing, I suspect. We're also doing complete snake genomes and lizard genomes and frog genomes. So instead of getting the 600 base pairs, we're going for the 1 billion base pair sequences so we can understand just how much diversity exists within species and how the codes work.
So they got those genome machines in China as well?
They have a phenomenally huge center for genomics in Shenzhen called Beijing Genomics Institute, even though it's privately run. In fact, there's part of a project that's designed to do 10,000 complete vertebrate genomes, which I'm one of the leaders in the herpetology groups with this. And China has agreed to do the first 101 species for the project at no cost to the group.
How long does it take to do a particular snake species genome?
Technically, probably the data gathering about a month. Once you have all these little sequence of fragments, you have to put them back together into an assembly process. And using the world's most powerful parallel processing computer systems, that can take up to 4 months.
4 months. And what do you think it might be one day?
Well, we now know based on new technology that's out that you can, if you have a model, do the complete human genome, as an example, in less than an hour for about $100. They expect the price to drop. The price right now is about $500. When the technology becomes highly functional, we can do a complete de novo or new genome probably for about $2,000 as opposed to today's price of about $200,000.
And what are you guys going to do with all those genomes of all those snakes and the frogs and lizards? Why is it important?
This is a mind limitation kind of thing. It depends on how far you can think out of the box in terms of what you do with this. Some species have very, very strong regenerative powers. Once we have the comparative genomics that are available, we'll be able to find these genes. And the genes probably exist in humans today. So in theory, if you lost a finger to an accident, this gene could get turned back on and you could regrow your finger. You could regrow your teeth, although you might regrow a complete set of teeth in the process.
Oh, that would be this. Wonderful.
Yes.
And cheaper, funnily enough, as well.
I think it would be much, much less expensive to do this. For example, we know that the teeth genes still exist in chickens. In fact, there's an effort that's been published saying that someone's going to create a toothed chicken. As a circus sideshow, I'd pay money to go see a toothed chicken just for fun.
I know. Do you remember Stephen Jay Gould's book, Hen's Teeth and Horse's Toes?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's some recent evidence. Most frogs don't have teeth on the lower jaw, but there's one that does. It was just recently published and discovered. So we know that the genes still exist within frogs, and it's just a matter of how to turn those genes on during development to have frogs with teeth on both jaws. So a lot of these historical functions are still contained within our DNA, but they're never really turned on.
So it will have usefulness not simply for those of you in classical systematics and so on, but also, who knows, illuminate our own human genomes and applications thereof.
That's the driving force behind it, in fact, is that we now have quite a few complete human sequences out there, but unless you go further down the evolutionary tree, you don't know how these things work or how they function or what the genes really do in many cases. And so the gist of this Genome 10K project is to get a great diversity of species sequenced, in part so we can understand how evolution has affected the development of animals, but ultimately so we can use this for humans.
Robert Murphy is curator of frogs and lizards at the Royal Ontario Museum in Canada. And Friday was Save the Frogs Day around the world. Next week on Catalyst, as you heard, electric cars, their revenge. And on The Science Show coming up, more revenge, what could be the slow death of the petroleum car. Peter Newman from Curtin University in Perth. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Charlie McCune. And how appropriate, don't you think, is our new Science Show theme. I'm Robin Williams.